the Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave. My daughter coughed in my mouth, and now I'm sick, Rupert. And with me, always, is Chris, looking healthier than I am, Coyer.
Barely, though. I just am ahead of you on having a little cold of myself. But no big deal here. We have, all the way across the globe, joining us, a friend of the show, Mr. Ben Schwarz. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how are you?
Fantastic. Yeah, it's been a little bit since you've been on, I think, but it's been great. I'm sure your life is about 10,000 times different than it was then. So what's been going on with you lately?
Yeah, lots of stuff. So, I did the show, 2013.
We were around in 2013.
Yeah, that's right. Better. A long time ago now. Let's see. So back then I was working on open source stuff a lot, and I had just released this thing called Gallery CSS where I did a screencast and sold it as an open source sort of thing.
Yeah, that was clever. How did that do? Was it worth doing?
Oh, did we not talk about that? I guess not. So at the time it paid my rent for a couple of months, I'd say like 2 months.
Nice, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I didn't really have any expectation for it other than like, oh, hopefully I can make a thing and people are interested in it. It was a bonus. And, you know, still some people buy it today. I think once a week maybe or something like that, I still get a sale for it. And I've thought about making it free for a long time, but instead I just donate the money. So I figured that's a nice thing to do.
You're part of that, you know, early days of the self-made tutorial entrepreneur in a way that worked out for you. Now there's a number of them. I even saw just this week that what are their names? Nathan and Steven released this like, you know, UI on the web book kind of thing.
UI.
Yeah, which is a hot release because Steven is known for these tweets that are like really super practical design advice from the digital age kind of thing. And I just know they're going to make $1 million on that thing. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, it's like when West Boss releases a course, it just crushes. Everybody buys it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's more common to see that because the tooling is there, you know? But what did you use in 2013? Do you have to write your own?
Yeah, it was on Gumroad. And it was kind of glued together with sticky tape and a few things. But I'm huge fans of what those guys are doing because they're just doing such a good job. Like the content is really good, but like their ability to market it and get it out to people and put all this free stuff out and, you know, super professional, really, really cool. So
isn't that funny how they come hand in hand sometimes though? Sometimes I'll get a question from somebody that's like, you know what, I'd like to make content too, but I'm not going to because I don't have the marketing chops that these other people do. And I'm like, you know what, I don't think that anybody who makes incredible content like that, you know, it's not that they're not marketing specialists, but they're just not afraid to give it a crack for some reason. And I have some doubts that there's all these people in the world that could create equally good content as any of these people, but just don't because they don't have the marketing chops. Like, I feel like that's a sucky cop out. Like, just if you think you can make amazing content, then do it and it'll work out okay for you, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think I like the idea of people charging for that rather than, you know, just putting out lots of free stuff. I think, you know, people being like, okay, this is a professional thing and I'm going to try really hard and I'm going to put out a good quality product. And then not being afraid to charge for it. I think.
Yeah. More charging.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I was in a room for a JavaScript meetup and the decided topic for discussion was about the event stream stuff. You know, that was a NPM vulnerability kind of thing happened. And nobody, there's lots of interesting things came up, but just as part of that discussion, it was like, God, there should just be more money flowing around maintainership of things than there is now, you know, because people are like, well, you know, maybe maintainers should be paid more. Maybe more maintainers should have Patreon accounts so that there's less abandoned repos because they have incentive to take care of it. I mean, I'm not sure that's like the answer, but it's a,
it's a complex thing, right? I've definitely worked in open source and felt underappreciated and like my time is being taken from me or that people were less than nice sometimes. But ultimately, I made a choice to not do that anymore and to focus on, you know, stuff that I was really interested in working on. And, you know, you kind of can't let you can't judge people for doing that. If people are putting their time into something and they're doing a good job and they're careful and thoughtful, you got to take care of them. And so I think we do need somehow to be more supportive of open source.
Yeah, I hope so.
I forget who called it out on Twitter, but somebody was kind of going through all the Vue community websites and plugins and things like that. And Vue does that community does a really good job of like dropping a Patreon link and being like every project has like a sponsorship tier almost. And it's pretty impressive. It's just that like, you know, that from the get go, they're thinking like, for this one dumb, I don't know, router or whatever, I'm going to have a sponsor, a gold tier and a silver tier. And, you know, I think that just like a conference would.
Do you think that there's evidence that doing it that way leads to less abandonware?
Oh, I mean, just anecdotal personally. I mean, you pay me to do something. Even if it's $2, I'm happy. That's great. Yeah. That was an exchange of capitalism. I don't know. But if I get $0, man, and you're taking my weekend. That's rough. So
I also think and maybe this is a generational thing too, of a newer generation coming through where they're like, no, this is a thing that we can do. And we're going to test out these ideas. And we're going to see if we can market it and make a nice graphic that sits at the top of the repo and, you know, have a tweet that goes viral or have a thing that people use. Like, I think people, or maybe younger folks coming into the industry are more interested in that sort of, hey, no, I can be everything. You know, I don't just put myself in the box of I write some JavaScript and it does a thing. And if that's the case, I think that's really exciting because that means that you've got a new group of people who are just so focused on trying to build their own thing. And you know, maybe they'll all be business owners in 5-10 years, right? So
hopefully.
Yeah.
Fast forward for you, you became one of those things, didn't you? Ben has a product called Calibre. It's CalibreApp.com. Both Dave and I were like, it's Calibre, right? It's Ben calls it Calibre, and it's a performance testing tool. So, a hosted one. So, if you're interested in getting some insight into the performance of your app, it is as easy as signing up for it and giving it a URL, pretty much, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Well, you pitch it to us now.
So I run this service called Calibre, and it's centered around trying to make the web faster, and that's kind of everything that the company is focused on doing, whether it be, you know, writing content and articles and stuff like that, trying to help people learn how to debug their React project or trying to see new stuff that's coming through in the browser. But then, from the application side, it's used by a few hundred companies from all over the world. And, you know, they're all trying to get the same answer. They're trying to figure out, you know, where they are and how to make things faster and more accessible and better for their customers, right? So
I wonder if it's early days for this, but it seems like one of those products that everybody should have on their app, that really literally everybody has at certain scale of company, everybody's got Pingdom or something watching your servers to make sure they go down or they don't. Everybody's got Sentry and Honey Badger or something in there to track bugs, you know, to make sure that, you know, I'm getting error reporting happening for me. Everybody should have some performance thing watching your site too. It just seems like part of this apps that you just automatically have because of course you do, you know,
mm-hmm.
That seems smart to me because it's not just like, hey, we're going to do a little performance sprint. Let's watch performance today on this site. Let's see how many requests it was triggered. But this doesn't do that. It watches it every day, every hour, whatever it is, because I want to be warned if bad things happen. Like somebody made a push that all of a sudden smashed the performance of this site. Maybe it didn't trigger any bugs. Maybe or anything, but it's kind of a bug. It's a performance bug, you know, I should be alerted of that in the same way that I'm alerted of anything else.
Well, I mean, maybe those things happen over a long period of time too. I mean, teams get busy and they keep adding little bits and pieces and your manager says, oh, we want this other thing. And you kind of get it in quickly because you have to. And you know, over some time, your pages do get slower. But yeah, when I started Calibre, for me, it was an interest thing. I had always been interested in performance and sort of learning about what made the web work. But I didn't I didn't perceive it to be maybe a viable business or anything like that at the time. I was interested in it. And what we're seeing now, I think is a bunch of strong evidence that people are becoming more concerned about performance, and they're becoming more thoughtful about it. And I think what's exciting for me is that we as an industry really struggle to get down to the very core of like the people that we're building for. And you know, we say that we're building for real people, but we don't test on, you know, the browsers they use, or we don't use the cheaper phone that they maybe use. You know, if you go and look at your web stats and you see that they're using an older, slower phone than the, you know, $2,000 iPhone that you have sitting on your desk, or your $3,000, you know, MacBook Pro spec'd up supercomputer, you know, or even the fact that, like, you know, I don't know the stats of the US, but in Australia, like, 1 in 5 people have a vision impairment problem. So, you know, if you think about those things, like, people don't sort of throw those stats out when they're like, oh, how much IE is there? And they're like, oh, it's only 3%. And it's like, yeah, okay, cool. So you could have made something more accessible for people who can't see your content, right? So, I'm, I guess, excited/hopeful that, we start to really focus on that stuff, because it's kind of important, right?
Yeah, and when it's hard to stop at just important. You're like, well, important, why? You know, well, it's important for those people. So it's one thing to say, okay, well, you know, you're a hero of the world if you care about that stuff, and you're Robin Hood, or, you know, I don't know, whatever. Moralistically, you're correct, but it's like, nah, I don't know if you know, as much as we might want it to, maybe morals aren't like enough for people to actually to change en masse, you know? So, but usually there's money to be made in these things too, right? Which is not, you know, it's nice when those incentives can align, right? That if you do a good job for a fifth of the population, maybe you'll stand to make a fifth more money, which doesn't hurt.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible, right? That, people will look at you in a different light, but also it just comes down to, you know, performance and accessibility are just, they're one of many facets of user experience. So, you know, if people perceive something to be readable, faster, you know, fits on your device, all of those things, they're just going to keep coming back. And maybe they don't even know why they're coming back. They're just like, that was good. That was a good experience. I enjoyed that, you know, and I care about that. So,
yeah, it's tough to quantify those kind of, like, you know, almost hidden things, you know, the instant gratification equals satisfaction or dopamine, like, it triggered by your brain, and therefore, like, you had a good experience on some website, so you just keep going back because it seems like a cool, good website.
You know? Yeah, you know, so in Australia, there's a restaurant called Attica. And it's like a very super fancy restaurant, and it's the chef's name is Ben Shrewy, and he's been on Chef's Table and all of those things, and, you know, he's like the coolest guy in cooking, right? I follow him on Instagram, and he's you know, he's always showing interesting ingredients and all stuff like that. But I saw a post just the other day where he had a framer, like a picture framer, frame new liquor licenses that were going to hang in the restaurant, right? And basically his comment was that, like, a restaurant is, it's 1,000 little details that you put together that people probably won't even notice the fact that, like, you've got these really nice frames for your liquor license that match your other artwork in the restaurant, right? They maybe don't see that and know that somebody put effort into it, but they're important details. I just like that so much because it just shows, like, at the level that he is operating a kitchen and a restaurant and commercial concerns of running those things. So yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. He has the experience dialed down to the, like, liquor license. I mean, I don't know, Dave Rupert restaurant just duct tapes it to the side of the bar or whatever.
Maybe. But you'd think if you care about things to that level, then, you know, the butter that you buy is probably pretty damn good too. Like by the time you're caring about those details, that is pretty good. I wonder if there's a performance analogy there, and that, like, if you're if you're tree shaking, you're already browser caching pretty well, I hope. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. This gets me all the time in Perf. This is kind of what I wanted to talk about. Is I feel like I gave a talk way back when I was first getting into performance years ago. I feel like the story was, here's how you do performance well. Optimize all your files. All your test files and your images and everything that you can optimize programmatically, you optimize them. Make sure your browser caching is on because it's a super big deal. Manage your cache well. You should probably buy your way out of server-side performance the best you can. Like if you have a slow server and it's returning the document in 1,200 milliseconds, get something going on the server side so that document's coming back in like 100 to 200 milliseconds. I don't know back-end stuff, but I feel like that's something that matters.
Juice up the back-end. That's the technical term.
Yeah, and reduce requests. Like if you can combine requests and load less things, that's good. And I feel like, and then I was like, okay, you're done. You did it. And now these days, I feel like nobody, not that nobody talks about that stuff. I'm sure that there's plenty of talks about that, but all performance discussions have gotten way more freaking complicated to the point where I like hardly know what we're even talking about anymore. And I'm just like, I don't know. I've never code split anything in my life. That's embarrassing. I know what code splitting is. Don't read too much into that, but I don't really get it. You know, like I don't think about it every day. I don't consider it a vital part of my performance strategy on the sites I work on, you know?
Yeah. So I got a couple of things I want to add here. Because I think about this stuff quite a lot. So all of the things that you said, like, oh, you know, you should gzip your responses, you should reduce things, you should, you know, all of that stuff. Like you haven't been lied to, right? Like all of those things, if you do them, will more than likely make your website faster and better. And like, you know, if you don't know anything other than those things, keep doing them. Like they work. They're good. They're good to do. Make them part of your practice. Make them, you know, automate them. Make it as simple as possible so that you can't not do that, right? But you know, going into the newer levels of things, and I think that you know, I've got the perspective of someone who works. You know, sometimes I end up reading browser source code to try and figure out how a browser does a particular thing, like fetching resources. I wrote a little article on old CSS tricks, I guess last year.
That's a good one. It was called The Critical Request or something like that. And it was about how it's not, you know, it's possible to work on websites and just have no idea that there's a priority of assets that get downloaded that is not obvious. It's not exactly just source order. There's all kinds of different reasons why a network request might be triggered, and the browser's also deciding which ones are more important than other ones and which ones block other ones and which ones don't. And that was kind of what you were talking about. They even have a number, don't they? Don't they literally have a request have a number?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you know, to even research that content, to write that article, like I knew that there was a priority system. But I had to go and read Chrome source. And then I tapped up old Paul Irish. And I said, Paul, how does this work? And he was like, I'm going to get back to you. You know, so like if you know, we're trying to like research for articles like that to be able to explain it to people, I think there's no wonder that, you know, and like coming back to it a little bit, how a browser decides to just download a file is a pretty fundamental thing to the way that the web works, right? And I think it's interesting that, you know, the web development community have got to a point where they don't understand those kind of basic level things. And I certainly didn't know that at all. And so for me, it's a lot of research and a lot of being curious enough to go, I'm going to find out, no, really, how does this actually happen? So yeah, I think there's no wonder that it feels daunting to anyone else
That's your version of framing a liquor license, though, in a way, right? Like that's you caring about details to a level that makes you have a really nice restaurant. But I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe that metaphor is worn out a little bit, but certainly not. It's not expected of every single person on earth to understand their critical request nature. Or are there a few takeaways as part of that critical request stuff that maybe people really should be aware of?
Yeah. No, well, it's the best article I've ever written on CSS tricks. I actually read the article because we put it in the show notes here already. And I had a little flick through it. I often read my writing a year later and be like, did I do a good job of this? And there's a lot of good stuff in there. So apart from like learning how a browser makes those decisions and why, like it goes through like the three or four methods that JavaScript will go through before it decides to like load something and why. I think that's super fascinating and something that everyone should just know as they add, you know, script tags and add an async attribute, what that's going to do to their page. Or if they place it above an image, for example, does that change something? Those are things that we should know. And like, maybe it's not like the most important thing, but they're good little details. And then the biggest thing I think that I learned from that article was the power of the two kind of newer things, newer features, which are preload, where you can tell the browser to, hey, you don't know this yet, but you're going to need this resource. So this resource could be a font or a CSS file or something. And you can just tell it, hey, just go and download it now. And that's really cool because that's an early hint. So like if your browser doesn't know that there's a web font coming to it somewhere in a style sheet, and it hasn't downloaded the web font, that's when we get that like that jerky load experience. And so you can prefetch that that web font.
Isn't that fascinating? There's so many things going on there. That preload is your opportunity to as a developer to say something like, I freaking hate fout and foit or whatever. And so I'm telling you, not only preload this, because I'm trying to fight those things or whatever, but also you're making a choice there that you should be super aware of making, is that I'm halting the rest of the rendering of this page by making that choice. I think that's a big deal too. It isn't just like, oh yeah, I'm going to hook you up, browser. I'm going to tell you that you're going to need to load this asset. Oh, that's nice. But you're like, it's like an intentional performance hit you're making. It might actually, in the end, make it perceived faster, better, right? Like it's at odds. You're making a choice. It's like, I want this to be slower so it feels faster. I think that stuff is fascinating. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Gumroad, like gum, like chewing gum. Gumroad.com/Shop Talk Show. I bet you've seen it before because it's all over the place. It's this great e-commerce platform to help you sell particularly digital stuff. So, you know, podcasters use it, or musicians will use it to like sell their album because you need to like be delivered the digital files of the albums, or writers will use it to sell a book, or little app, you know, creators will use it to sell their little app. Here's an example of where you might come across it. I came across this little app called Pixel Snap, you know, a little while back, but it's this genius little like Mac OS menu bar app with a key command, and you fire off the key command and you get little crosshairs as your cursor, and it's drawing little bars all over that to tell you the dimensions, like how many pixels away certain things are. A little hard to describe on the radio, but it's for when you're designing something and you're like, how far should that margin or padding be, or what should the width be of this particular element? You just do this thing and it just draws the little bar, and you're like, oh, I see, it's 141 pixels or whatever. It's so cool. So you go to getpixelsnap.com, you click on buy now for $15, and when you click that button, you go to Gumroad. And Gumroad, it does all the hard e-commerce part stuff. It'll be, you know, I want this, and you click the I want this button, and it takes the money from the people and gets their email address and payment information, and then gives them a nice little receipt and gives them a way to safely digitally download that file. So you don't have to build any of that infrastructure. It's not that you can't build that infrastructure, but that's a lot of work, you know, whereas Gumroad enables you to do it in 5 minutes, get set up on it. You know, it's incredible. I love using Gumroad. I like it when other people sell stuff on Gumroad because I know it's going to be easy to check out and buy. It's going to be great. So we're not selling anything at Shop Talk just yet, but we set up gumroad.com/shoptalk. So you can hit that URL to sign up for it just so you have a Gumroad account, or as particularly if you want to sell something, go do it that way.
Let me give you the hint. All right, so I estimate that you can make pretty much every website 3 to 5 seconds faster if you if you're not preloading your fonts, to preload them, firstly. I mean, you should do all the other stuff like, do we really need a web font here? Can we delete one of the weights? Can we do anything to reduce the weight here? But if you definitely preload it, and if you also use the font display CSS property, which goes on the font face declaration, you can say either swap it or optional, right? And if you do just those two things, which literally, I mean, I haven't seen every code base in the world, but you can probably do this in less than 5 minutes. You don't even have to tell your manager about it. You can sneak that in for free. And suddenly you've got 3 to 5 seconds in your back pocket. And that is really cool, right? Like, hey, it's 2018. Shouldn't we be able to put text onto a screen quite quickly? Yeah, we should be.
And when you say preload the font, do you mean like just as simple as link rel preload href equals my font.waf 2? Or what do you mean by preload?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. The only attribute that you missed that you definitely need is the cross origin attribute. But
cross origin.
Yeah.
Well, and it will totally fail if you. Yeah. Literally, they're all required.
Yeah. They're all required for fonts. That's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you use that link rel preload tag, you can also do it as a HTTP header if you've got control of that stuff. The browser will say, "Oh, cool! I need this. This is a high priority. I'm going to download it right now because you've told me because you know better." Right. So,
and you go for the WAF file, right? Like if I had like base64 fonts or something like that, I'm really not getting a gain, or should I try the link rel preload as style or whatever?
Mm-hmm. So the thing about every browser that supports preload also supports WAF or WAF 2. Actually, mm-hmm. WAF 2, I believe. So you should just use WAF 2 because they're better compressed than any other font format that we have available to us. Don't use base64 for fonts, basically. If you base64 a font and put it into a style sheet, you're basically you're blocking the browser from painting while it downloads this big base64 resource. So that's another one. And that was a thing. I said before, all these performance rules that we hear are true and they make everything better for sure. But there have been a couple of things along the way, like icon fonts are particularly bad for performance. Base64ing things is particularly bad. There's a couple of others too. Like, oh, if you remove just one JPEG, you've removed just as much, file transfer as a JavaScript, all of your JavaScript, right? So you should remove that one JPEG, but that's not true either. That JavaScript and images are not equal in terms of what they do to a device once they've downloaded.
Maybe one of the like early successes of teaching people about performance was put your scripts at the bottom. I don't know how that became so like well integrated into developers' minds, but I feel like everybody does that these days. And I wonder if that was a kind of a deferred our thinking about critical request stuff, because JavaScript is one of the worst offenders of this kind of thing, but everybody loads their scripts at the bottom, so it's like kind of became not a big deal,
Yeah, I don't know when scripts at the bottom happened. I feel like I was doing this in 2005-ish, back when I was working at an agency.
Yeah, so
I don't know. Yeah, absolutely.
Somebody wrote in the other day as a question, should I, if I loaded the scripts at the bottom, does it matter if I put async on the script tag? And I was like, I don't think it does that much.
It does.
I don't know. Maybe you're right. It does matter. Yeah.
It can matter. It depends if there are other scripts underneath it. Because the browser can stop basically at that point if you imagine it reading along in the document. So yeah, it can happen.
It can matter. I suppose if the second script depends on something from the first script, that could be a problem too, I suppose.
Yeah, getting all of that stuff, like if you don't have some kind of very clever module system that loads everything and knows how to load everything, trying to be like separating even like a vendor script where you've got all of your React or and dependencies or whatever, all of that junk in one file, and then the next file, it's still hard to kind of sync that up, definitely.
Mm-hmm. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by WooCommerce. That's WooCommerce.com. It's a WordPress plugin for your WordPress site that brings powerful e-commerce stuff to it. So if you want to sell something, take money for something, do it through your WordPress site. I think it alone is a reason to pick WordPress because it can, you know, do e-commerce for you really nicely. But I do think it's kind of nice that maybe you do e-commerce, but your site does other things as well. It's used for content or your portfolio or something. You can use WordPress for that and not have to give up e-commerce or pick a platform specifically for e-commerce, because you get e-commerce and you get all the power of WordPress by going the WooCommerce route, which is nice. I use it for all kinds of stuff. We've even on CodePen right now, it sells our t-shirts and has like a plugin for handling just exactly how we do fulfillment of orders and shipping with ShipStation and all that stuff. It's a plugin, so it's powerful by itself, but there's this whole ecosystem of plugins that expand what it's able to do. I even like their little slogan on their homepage right now, that businesses use WooCommerce to sell everything from luxury mattresses to cupcakes to kayak lessons to handcrafted jewelry online. So it's like something like kayak lessons requires people picking a date and a time and having slots and stuff. You can do that kind of thing. You know, luxury mattresses probably require pretty complicated like shipping rules and stuff to figure that all out. And we probably have to deal with taxes and inventory management and stuff. And then handcrafted jewelry, selling one-offs of something and having different types of shipping rules. It covers all that stuff, which is nice. And of course, WooCommerce scales as it scales, and WooCommerce isn't charging you a portion of profits or anything on top of anything else. So it's a nice scaling situation, because it's just, you know, there's generally just one-off fees for things or yearly upgrade fees, and that's about it. So check out WooCommerce.com. Pretty darn nice platform. So what else here is that, you know, there's like total page weight. That could be a metric that I could see be really easily being added to a performance budget. I know we didn't really talk about performance budgets yet, so we could do that. But like, is that one that, you know, should be squarely in people's eyes anymore? Or is the story gotten complicated enough to the point where you're like, I don't know. It's not that you should not worry about performance weight, but you know, there can easily be a 2 megabyte total weight website that's a lot faster than a 1 megabyte, you know, website that is poor in other ways, like in how badly it blocks things.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a signal of something. And, you know, I think we need to read these signals and interpret them and try and figure out what they actually mean. In terms of like, you know, page weight in total, I guess you've got to think about people's data plans. You've got to think about people who have connections that are, you know, somewhere closer to the global average. Maybe the global average is like 7.2 Mbps. So that's my connection here is 115. So I'm definitely using a connection that's a lot faster than the average global, right? So for me, 2 megs of something ain't no thing. But to somebody who's, you know, in the wrong end of the building with bad Wi-Fi, or their phone plan isn't quite working and they're trying to text their partner on the way home, what vegetables do you want? You know, I can't read this recipe, or whatever it is. Like, you don't know the context that people are using your sites in. And so the thing is, you've got to plan for the worst, and you've got to make it really good. And if you do that, it'll be really, really great for people who are on fast hardware and connections. I think I skipped your question altogether, though. What was it? It was about the page weight. Yeah. Okay.
No, I like that it's, you know, just because another metric matters too doesn't make this other metric not matter or something. You know, they're kind of all important in their own way. Like, or maybe here's another one. Like, what's your favorite metric? Like, if there's, is it possible to say, like, what are the most important 3 metrics, or is it just not that simple?
Look, it's not that simple. I work a little bit with the Lighthouse team, and we talk a lot about, oh, I wish there was one metric that we could tell people, this is the one that you just should use. I have a lot of my customers ask the same thing, like, oh, we're going to track this with our management, and we're going to have KPIs for this metric, which is really cool that companies are doing that, and I'm super excited by that change, because that's a cultural change that's definitely happened this last year, is that companies are doing that. But to answer your question, I think the time to interactive is a really interesting metric. Should I explain how that kind of works, or?
Oh, well, say it again. This is the time until
time
interactive.
To interact.
TTI.
TTI. Yeah.
Okay. So I can just in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, it's like one of these websites that it loads and I can see it and there's a button, but I can't press the button because whatever JavaScript powers that button isn't available for me to do that yet. So my TTI hasn't hit yet. Mm-hmm. So the TTI is still coming.
Well, it can be more aggressive than just the button that you can't click, right? Like it could be you're on your phone on the couch, and you're looking something up that you've just seen on TV, and you're like, oh, hey, this is interesting. I can see this article, and you can see the text, and you start to scroll, but your phone doesn't move at all, right?
Like it's prevented scrolling.
It's prevented scrolling entirely.
Wow. And so
what's at play here is the JavaScript main thread. And so if you imagine that, you know, you've got this single threaded environment where you're trying to shove all your JavaScript, and in some cases that's like, you know, it might be 400K gzipped, but once it's ungzipped, it might be almost 2 megs, right? And so your phone has suddenly got this giant wad of script that it has to interpret, turn into something that it can run, and then execute it on your page, which is still downloading, maybe in the background, right? And so when we talk about time to interactive, we're looking for a period of 5 seconds where there's no major CPU or, it's called long task. So we're looking for a period where there's no long tasks on the main thread.
So the main thread is ready to accept your DOM scrolling events, and it's ready. Like you can just tell it's ready to rock. It's ready for users to use it.
That's right. That's right. And so it's such a really interesting metric in the way that it describes a real world thing that happens on every site. There's yesterday I saw a carousel that was doing all of its animation in JavaScript, and it was pretty slow on a desktop even, right? When it was profiled on a phone, it was bad. Like, it wasn't just slow, it was a very frustrating experience for a user. Mm-hmm. And so I think that time to interactive, if you're going to pick only one metric, and I don't think it's like the metric, but if you're only going to pick one, it's a really interesting one to start with because it describes an experience on a slow phone as well. Like if you have a TTI metric from a slow phone, the average, like the global average for that metric is 19 seconds, right? 19 seconds to get to interactive. If you think about that in the context of your site where you're like, yeah, look, I hit enter and I see it like 3 seconds later, everything's cool. It's like, well, it might not be everywhere. And I think that like having a metric that takes you immediately there to be like, this isn't great everywhere, and you need to think about that. I think a metric that can do that is powerful because I think other people who in your team who aren't looking at dev tools all day will get that too, right? It's explainable. I think a good metric is explainable and people get it.
Yeah, yeah. Those acronyms go a long way, believe it or not, like as cheesy as they are, if you get people talking about TTIs at your company, you're probably doing good.
What's the KPI on the TTI?
Yeah. business stocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Up, always up. I definitely, this is like stuff I do, but I swear I can hear web pages piecing together when they're going very slow. Like I can hear the pieces like chuck, 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 chuck.
What about, is it, there's no reason, why is this so bad? I don't know that we all feel this to some degree, right?
Every single website is loading a copy of Doom, Chris.
I mean, right. Like that's a joke, but also the original size of Doom is smaller than the average website or something like that. It's pretty incredible. So well, how did we get here? Isn't that wild? And I don't even know where to take this because it's kind of like, is the platform bad? It would be very tempting for us on the show to say, of course not. The platform is not bad. You can do amazing things on it. The web is just the place to be. It's incredible. And there's no reason it has to be slow either, but for some reason, so many people are making it slow, but I guess, but you know, whose fault is that? What happened? What's the way out of this? Don't say amp, go.
Okay. So I like this. It's good. I mean, I can talk about amp if you want to.
No, you
maybe you I'll trick
absolutely
you.
Can talk about amp.
I'll if trick like. You into talking about
we'll
it
just,
later.
We just bleep that word out here.
You'll just edit that out, right?
Yeah.
So, look, I think the way that we got here, you got to look at the age of the web, and you know, I started using the web for the first time when I was 17. I'm 34 now, right? And so it's been a big part of my life, as I'm sure it has been of yours as well. You know, I started building sites in Dreamweaver, and you know, then. You know, found a text editor and fell in, right? That's what happened. I was doing it early builds in Netscape before Firefox was a thing. Back then, like, that was the absolute dawn of the web as we know it, right? And we're not that old. We're not like, I mean, look, I can see some gray hairs on the both of you there, right? But and I got them too, don't worry. But the web isn't that old. I mean, it's been around for a while, but it's not that old. And we, you know, back in those days that I'm referring to, like, if you think about, like, the kind of web design that we had, it was like 11 pixel fonts and, you know, GIFs that we had downloaded from somewhere and all of that kind of stuff. And it wasn't good web design. It was interesting and creative and fun for us, but it wasn't anything beyond that, right? Like, it barely served the purpose of, like, a restaurant being able to have their menu out. And so...
But I suppose just because it doesn't have a giant framework rendering in, it was still... I feel like the image we used then were bigger. The fonts were just as big. Like, I don't know. It's like almost like we were being dumber about performance back then. And the internet was slower. And yet it was faster somehow, at least in my mind. Like,
yeah.
Now we're making sites simpler, more trimmed, on faster internet, and they're worse.
Yeah, I think the ambition grew, right? So we went from these dinky little sites that were cute and that we liked, and then we went through the Tumblr era, which is still the best part of my life, for sure. But, you know, we just became more ambitious. We were like, well, we want to build apps, and we want to build things that serve these people. And, you know, like, the tooling was very slow to come along to actually meet what we were trying to do. And we were trying to be really ambitious with JavaScript, and we're like, no, we can do all of this. We don't need Flash. We've got this, like, powerful tool here, and we can build anything. And that's exciting, because you've got a bunch of really creative, talented people building and just going for it, right? That, like, nothing is too hard. Like, I can add rounded corners to that. I know I can do it, you know, before we could do it in CSS, right? Like, we were doing that anyway. So we were kind of doing really bad, silly things because we were just like, we didn't want to say no. We wanted to build something creative and interesting. And I think the thing that's exciting about now as a time is that we're becoming aware of those things that we did and those trade-offs that we made. And we're starting to think about what it means to actually build a really great product. And you know, I know that web developers focus and so much on this stuff. And it's really hard to be actually excellent on the web. Like, it is actually very, very difficult. But, you know, just a little bit of attention and a little bit of, you know, socializing it with our management and being able to talk to our friends on the design team or being in a design team and being able to influence that change, that's really cool.
So do we need somebody to step in and save us or can we, do you think we got this?
No, we got it. We're a very talented group of people. And there was this Twitter thread the other day about DevRels and performance and all of that stuff. And I'll leave the hot takes to the Twitter dumpster fire. But, you know, like, right now is so exciting for the web. All these major companies have DevRels out there who know how browsers do stuff. And, you know, if they don't know, they can ask the engineer who wrote it, right? So we have that information at our fingertips and you know, we got to just start extracting it and start. It's a long process, you know, and the web isn't going anywhere and we're going to be here too. So we just need to slowly get better. And, you know, if we don't, it's probably fine too.
referencing that little bit of hot drama, I think the argument was sort of, we put too much emphasis, or Google DevRels put too much emphasis on the first page load, you know, and they don't consider the whole entire megabytes of experience that I'm providing. What, you know, do you think that's true, or, you know, what, or do you think like just being knowledgeable of that trade-off is enough?
Firstly, I don't know why the like Chrome DevRel particularly, why they hear that stuff from people so much. I think people really want to not trust Google, and I can understand their motivations for that in terms of privacy and that sort of stuff, and devices that are listening to you in your house and all of that. I respect that for sure. But if you look at the people who are building those tools and browsers and helping to circulate those ideas, they've been doing it for a long time, and they've been doing a very good job of it. And so I don't believe, if you look at their intent and if you look at their output also, I think that they've been, as an organization, one of the most positive things about making the web better than it is for the last 5 years. I don't believe any other organization has been able to do what they've been able to do. And I know that sounds like a Michelle, but that's how I feel. And what was the second part of your question? Is that like,
do we focus too much on first page load, or like that initial experience?
I don't think we focus enough.
That's actually really fair.
Yeah. If you're busy, it's easy to miss stuff, right? And the fact is that, like, you know, I run a performance product, and is it the fastest thing in the world to use? No, the answer is it isn't. I have to load data in the back, and I still have some old Angular that I, you know, wanted to use and decided not to later on, and then switched it to something else. Like, I have the same problems everyone else does. And I weigh those concerns with, this really could be a bit better than it is. I hope I can get to that one day soon. It's a huge balancing act for sure.
It's funny how much of that, the pain, it's like we make choices as a developer to ship pain for our convenience, because we kind of have to, because there's always a trade-off. Like, we have to, you know, if there's no developer ergonomics at all, then we can't make products, and there's no company at all. And those of us in the kind of the SaaS realm of, like, you know, that we got to keep this ship afloat. You know, there's, you know, and that pressure gets even bigger the more people you have involved. You know, you can imagine if you're the head of a 100-person company, the pressure on you to make sure that you're evolving and doing right by business, and that it's a little, you know, sometimes hard to prioritize, like somebody complaining about 100 kilobytes of data or something. You're like, I don't know, just whatever. But I'm not trying to argue against performance. I'm hopefully the last person in the world to convince you to do that, but this stuff just rattles through my brain. You know, there's so much at work. I was at a meetup again the other day, and there's a presentation about RxJS. You seen that? Everybody use that? It's great. It's like this library it's kind of a programming paradigm of, like, there's asynchronous events, and I want to send them through a pipeline of stuff in which to react to them. And it's just a way of organizing code in a way that, you know, works for a lot of people's brain really well, and it's cool. But I'm like, I was thinking about it, and I was like, this has no user-facing nothing. You know, like, I'm taking up a big chunk of JavaScript, and I'm shipping it to every single person that uses my website just so that I can write a pipe for my data or whatever. You know, like, it has no, there's no benefit to the user, whatever, except my ergonomics as a developer. That's it. So it just made me think about that. Like every library that we use is like that. And it's amazing. How many choices can we make like that just to make my job easier? Like, what's the, when does that
stop? I had one, like, yesterday. I was, you know, I'm working on a Vue app just because I was like, I'm going to try it. And I put Axios in there to handle my Ajax requests, you know?
Yeah. That's just for you. That's just for you.
Just for me. Well, I was like, why would I use native? Or, like, I'm just going to use Axios because it's, like, asking me if I want to install it, you know, on the next installer, create next app or whatever. And I just was like, well, sure, I'll just use Axios. I haven't used it before. And then I was like, well, these are just fetch requests. I should just be using fetch. And then I was like, yeah, wait, no.
The error handling for fetch is super bad.
Axios can like intercept in local cache and start doing all these things maybe more efficiently than I could program or maintain.
So it's not like, just for you.
Now I get it, you know, and so.
I don't know.
So anyway, it turned out like better, but it is like, you know, I don't even know, 5-11 kilobytes that I'm sending down just for like calling something that exists for 0 kilobytes.
But it's like, okay, 5 kilobytes, that's probably worth it. But then it's like, as soon as we have a little bit more space, as soon as our website starts feeling fast enough, you know, and as soon as we, you know, I don't know, somebody at the office gets fiber when they didn't before, and it started being like, this is fine, then I feel like libraries just evolve to get bigger to provide us even better ergonomics, you know? I think that, well, it'll always be a thing. The analogy I always think of is the, like, how the pads that, you know, American football players wear get better and better, and as they get better and better, the aggressiveness of the game just gets more aggressive to compensate for it. You just hit a little harder when you got better pads.
Look, I think it's easy to get overwhelmed with, you know, the package managers and the build tools and the, should I use this? I heard Vue's really good. Maybe I shouldn't use this other thing. Maybe, you know, like, people get anxious about that stuff. I do too. It's really easy to do that. But I think as long as you're coming to the whole process of what you're building and what you're doing with a little bit of, you can keep doing the same things that you were doing yesterday, but as long as you're thinking about the people who are using it, and as long as you're just trying to make it just a little bit better, or, you know, even come up with a hypothesis of what you think is happening. Why is this page so slow? Why does it feel bad on my phone? Like, even if you don't answer that question every day, you're going to get to the point where suddenly you're like, huh, I reckon I've got a theory that if we did XYZ, we could save, you know, 5 seconds here. And I'm going to do a little experiment that no one even needs to know about. And those experiments are so fun because it lets you just push everything else out of the way for maybe half an hour. I like to, personally, I set myself a challenge. You know, if it's like the end of the day and I don't want to do anything else, I'll be like, I reckon I could probably do that in half an hour. And, you know, maybe it takes an hour. That's fine. Those little things do push everything along, and they inspire your coworkers to be like, oh, cool. Okay, there is something here. Let's actually dedicate some time to this.
Yeah. I had a good story about that just happened in the last couple of days for me. You know, we have embedded pens on CodePen, right? Like you make a pen and you copy and paste some code and you put it on a site. What that is a paragraph tag. And the paragraph tag says, see the pen, cool rainbow thing by Sally on CodePen. And there's links in there. And then if the JavaScript runs, it'll replace that paragraph tag with an iframe of the embed. That's the nature of it. It's progressive enhancement. It works pretty well. But when your paragraph tag that's maybe 30 pixels tall loads an iframe that's 300 pixels tall, there's reflow, and it's kind of nasty. And I was like, you know what? That's embarrassing that I've had that go that long with that much reflow that it triggers on people's sites. So I just wrote on my own site, I wrote a little PHP to regex to look for that paragraph tag that the CodePen ships with the data height attribute, and it injects an inline style in it, like at the server side level, that sets the height attribute of that paragraph tag to be the same height as the iframe is going to be. So then it loads up and it's the same thing, but it just kept me thinking like, oh, that reflow is so janky. I'm going to do a little, you know, experiment to see if I can kind of fix that thing. And lo and behold, I'm like, that's a pretty good way. So that fixed it on my site. And then I'm like, you know what? I'll ship something to CodePen that just puts that inline style in there for everybody else too, so that it's just ready to go when you copy and paste the code. And I don't know if customers will love that or hate it, but it seems like hopefully they'll like it, because, you know, preventing reflow is always kind of nice. But I like what you said, you know, keep the perform little experiments, be thinking about it all the time. Even if you can't act on it right away, at least you're being perf-minded, yeah? Why don't you tell us about that type of thing, but also for next year? You know, like, what's happening in 2019? Can we give people some ways to think about perf?
Yeah, you asked this question, like, what can we do for next year to really think about making the web faster and better than it is today? And I wanted to, I've got three things here. And so the first thing is that what gets monitored gets managed. And that's been a phrase that's, you know, you've maybe heard before, but it's really true. When a team starts to have metrics, you know, then they actually really start to really focus on that, right? I went to a nutritionist recently, and I said, how would I lose, like, what would be the best thing to lose a couple of kilograms? And she said, you know, you're already tracking everything that you eat in this app. That's really good. And you're tracking your weight every day. She's like, I don't remember the percentage, but it was something like 70 or 80%, where she said 70 or 80% of people who track their weight lose more weight because they track it. And I think that we can see that also with web performance. If you get your team thinking about it, it'll definitely happen. The second thing is, remember that every single thing that you gzip, you know, and send down to a device is later then decompressed. If it's paused, so if it's a style sheet, the browser has to figure out, hey, this is a style sheet. I need to turn this into an AST that can be, you know, executed on the DOM. But, you know, with JavaScript, what happens is, you know, it's run. It's also compiled down to bytecode so that it runs on your CPU architecture, and a whole bunch of super nerdy stuff is happening in there. And so what's happening to that, you know, 400, 600, so the average is 600K. The average 600K of JavaScript is going to end up being, you know, about 2 megs at least. And so if you've got a phone
on client, like in memory on client,
in memory,
yeah, parsed.
That's right. And so that's, you know, we come back to talking about TTI, time to interactive. Your phone is suddenly having to deal with that. And so it's just a really good rule of thumb to remember that it's about 2.5 times the file size that you see reported by gzip. And, you know, that was definitely something that we learned years ago, that it was maybe misleading, that like, oh, it's gzipped, it's fine. It's not always fine, and it is something you need to think about. So just be mindful and aware that's true. And then the other thing, and I think that this for me was like sipping the magic elixir, was study global averages, study trends of connection speeds and devices. And remember that users don't have, you know, a $3,000 computer, probably, or a $1,300 phone with, you know, ridiculously fast internet. There's some really good resources to do this. There's a quarterly report from Akamai called the State of the Internet, or State of the Web, I think. And that has, you know, per region, you can go and say, in Korea, what is the average home wired connection speed, and what is the average, you know, phone, you know, network sort of speed. And just because something's, you know, 4G, it doesn't mean that that speed is equal in different parts of the world or even on different carriers. So once you can be aware of, you know, the conditions that people are using sites in, then I think you can get over to this point where you can pull your manager aside and be like, this is really important. I've got some metrics here because we monitor everything. I know that, you know, our TTI is this on this particular phone, and looking at our web stats, that is a significant portion of people. It's even more than the people that we support for like browser support, right? So let's do something about that. And I think you can make some positive changes if you come to the web with those three things.
Well, yeah, we should wrap it up. Thanks, Ben, coming on. You know, we just did that, the how to think like a front-end developer. And one of the themes that kept coming up was performance is a front-end developer's job. So I appreciate you taking your time, you know, like your very early morning. So thank you for getting up and being on the show. And for those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do
that? Yeah. I mean, you don't have to give me money, but I do like it, as everyone does. So on Twitter, I'm just Ben Schwartz, one word, but the company that I work on is called Calibre. It's caliberapp.com. You can find me there.
And Calibre has a new, like, newish CLI tool, so that's always fun.
Oh, yeah. It's really good, actually. I mean, I'm biased, but I think it's really good.
Yeah. There you go. Let's see how CLI tools are always fun, especially for quick judgments on people's websites. So,
yeah. I guess seeing as you mentioned it, I'll give you like the seven second run through of it. It's a command line interface that lets you automate parts of your performance system, you know, using Calibre. But one thing you can do is you can create a single page test against any page that's on the web from any corner of the globe. So there's 14 locations around the world. So if you're like, how fast is my site on a 3G connection in Mumbai, India? You can just run that single command and then you get a page that you can share with your team to be like, you know, you don't even need a login. Right, like your friends don't—they don't need a login, so you can just share this page. Be like, "Do you know that our page is that slow? Your heart, your voice will go all high." You know.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, and thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. We are wrapping up our 2018 year here, so we're going to go on a brief hiatus, but we'll be back in 2K19. We got ideas. We've written, I don't know, pages and pages of ideas for shows. So we're really excited about that. So stay tuned and tell your friends. If you're working on a side project over the holidays, as I think we all do a little bit, you know, try to beef up your performance. Do some of these tips. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one for the new year because people want to hire
people
like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.